This is Screen Divers. In this week's episode, we are talking about 1992, Unforgiven. Directed by Clint Eastwood, written by David Webb Peoples, produced by Clint Eastwood, and starring Clint Eastwood, Gene Hackman, Morgan Freeman, Richard Harris, and many other character actors, which we will discuss extensively. Cinematography by Jack Ann Green, edited by Joel Cox, music by Clint Eastwood and Lenny Niehaus, produced by the Malpaso Production Company, and distributed by Warner Brothers. This movie has a running time of 131 minutes. It was shot for a budget of $14.4 million and it raked 159.2 millions at the box office. How are you, Ricky?
I am okay and feeling a little bit worse for wear after my night last night, but there you go.
What'd you do last night, Ricky?
Oh, I went to see Oasis at Sydney, a core stadium, and I was at the front and I stood up for about 4.5 hours, and I drove back home last night, got home at around 2, but then I also dropped my parents off at the airport, so I was driving for a collective 5 hours over yesterday.
That sounds like a fit punishment for you going to see Oasis. In this week's episode, we have a very special guest. The king of the MTG altarists. The saltiest shipmate of all vets. The man who puts the N in Geiger. And the face of Big Red Chewing Gum in Japan. Welcome, Jeff Walker.
Pretty grand introduction. Thanks, Samba.
How you doing, man?
I'm good, dude. It's man. Early here, stateside, so.
What time is it there?
It's 5:20.
5:20. 5:20 in the morning. That's pretty early, man. You should have said no.
I got my Red Bull, though. I'm good to go.
So, before we begin, a quintessential question must be asked. Ricky, what is this movie about?
It's 1818 Wyoming, and we are in a little town called Big Whiskey. A horrific incident leads to a series of devastating events, creating adversity across all individuals involved.
You know what? I got 3 pages of notes from our guest.
Yep.
Jeff, you tell us. What is this movie about?
Oh, man.
Truly, what is this about?
I think Unforgiven is a movie that's about violence. Mm-hmm. But it's about our different relationships with violence. So I think it's about those who don't like doing it, mm-hmm. those who enjoy doing it. I think it's there's an interesting bit with like our relationship with violence as an audience, mm-hmm. as a consumer. It's about those who suffer from it, those who glorify it. I think that's the big thing. I think it's also a movie about communication.
It is. Yeah. It is, for sure. And it's very current, man. It's very current. This movie has been current for the past 30 years.
This was a revisit for me, you know, for probably been about 10 years since I watched it. And yeah, you're right. It's crazy, like, how relevant this movie still is. It's sad how relevant it still is.
Yeah. And it was, I mean, the subtext was there when it came out.
Sure. Yeah.
But it seems like, you know, to quote Shirley Bassey again, history repeats. It's just fucking constant.
Yeah, I think there's like a micro level and a macro level as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah, for sure.
Absolutely. I called Ricky a couple of days ago. We were in a conversation and I said to him that I couldn't stop thinking about a bit after watching this. We were talking about Gene Hackman, how fucking hypnotic he is. But, you know, we've seen other actors in that role, but he does this so well. We're going to discuss that extensively. But there is a sequence that reminded me of a bit by Bill Hicks. I think it was 1993 Revelations. That was a stand-up routine that you know, really made it poignant to the rest of the world. And that was shot at the Dominion Theatre in London. So it's, you know, the one that you can get, the recorded stand-up is that one. I think it's called Revelations.
Yeah, it is.
And there's a line uttered by Bill Hicks in there. He quotes the movie Shane and he quotes Jack Palance in there, tossing a gun at the sheepherder's feet and going, pick up the gun. Pick it up.
I'm so sick of arming the world and then sending troops over to destroy the fucking arms. You know what I mean? We keep arming these little countries, then we go and blow the shit out of them. We're like the bullies of the world, you know? We're like Jack Palance in the movie Shane, throwing the pistol at the sheep herder's feet. Pick it up. I don't want to pick it up, mister. You'll shoot me. Pick up the gun.
Now, we both laughed because I didn't even have to say to him that it was, you know, where it was from or whatever. And he said, yeah, man, I thought about it. You know, I thought about it too. And now I'm going to blow your fucking minds because I know that you guys are familiar with this. And it's an entire generation of Gen X, possibly late millennials that have been introduced to it by the, you know, older brothers or whatever, if they were lucky enough. And here's the kicker. I fucking hate AI because I'm using it for menial, trivial little tasks. And I fucking did it this morning. I went, hey, because I didn't remember the name of the routine to quote it on the show. And I said, hey, what's the name of today, Gemini? What's the name of the routine, the Bilix routine with this, you know? And Gemini says something that blew my fucking mind. So I actually just finished watching Shane this morning. The pick up the gun thing is not in Shane. It just never happened. I spent the past 30 years thinking it's not in there. It's not even close.
You got Mandela effect.
Oh my God, dude. We just ruined it for everybody. Go check. If you're listening to the show, fuck you. That's it. Fuck you too. They ruined it for us. Now it's ruined for you. It's not in there. And also, Jack Palance is not that dominant in that movie. I thought he was a true antagonist. It's minimal. You see him, it's barely on screen. And it's the guy, I thought, here's a sequence with the, you know, the farmer slash herder, whatever the fuck, that shows up in the mud in front of him. It's a confrontation. The guy's a gun in his hand. It's nothing. I actually want to watch that movie, the movie that was never, that never existed. It's a shame. And on that note, this was Umba.
It's done. It's all over. But interestingly enough, so we both reference that joke. And yes, Bill Hicks in Revelation says it's from Shane. Well, that was recorded in 93. So is it actually something that he loved about Jack Palance, but he used the scene in The Unforgiven because it would have been out around the same time.
I think so.
Yeah, it would have been out at the same time. But it's that same menace. It's that same, like, aggressive, you don't cross me because I've got every single point here covered and I know everything that's going to happen in the next 5 seconds. So
that scene too with Gene Hackman in the jailhouse with a Beauchamp. Sorry, you guys have to correct me.
Beauchamp.
The French.
Beauchamp. Croissant.
WW, that's croissant. What I'll call on that. So even after Gene Hackman like beats the shit out of him in the street, that isn't the scene where you realize what a sadist he is. It's not the physical violence. It's the complete like emasculation of English Bob. We were like, oh yeah, this guy's evil. It's not just where he just kicks the shit out of him in public and embarrasses him that way. The humiliation has to be complete physically, psychologically.
Yes, I heard that Eastwood doesn't do any takes, apparently, which is good because there's some magic happening here. I didn't notice the nuance of some of the shit that happens in that particular sequence. For our listeners, I'll probably put a sample. Like I, you know, did lately, this little kind of, it's almost a monologue, really. I mean, Beauchamp reacts, Saul Rubinek reacts to Gene Hackman here really well. And today I noticed something about his reaction. First of all, again, I cannot help myself but sing his praises. He's a fantastic character actor. I'm talking about Saul Rubinek, which, by the way, there's the theory that I think it was you as well that stipulated this, Jeff. And I, as much as you sent me notes.
You couldn't help but look at him.
I did. I have no self-control. I did glance at your notes. Yeah. That's why I hate you. I shouldn't have. All right. We don't talk about the show before the show.
Is it harder for you not to look at someone else's show notes than look at, like, pornography or something where you have to, like, you know, abstain yourself, you know, like.
He just has to work out how that sexual act is completed. And then he, like, stares at it for a while.
It's the only way I can come. It's the only way I can come. But I.
By reading someone's show notes.
Yeah. It's the only way I can come. Great. But I'm going to I'm going to take one good photo of your notes and put it in the comments of this episode once it's released.
No, don't. It's the ravings of a madman at like 2 a.m. after.
But anyway, after watching Shane, which, by the way, there are parallels to that movie as well. I mean, again, I see this movie as part of a trilogy, right, by Eastwood. I would put High Plains Drifter in first place, then Pale Rider, then this one. You know, but that's mine, and we're here to talk about it. I can see already fucking
interesting
Ricky reacting, but that's, you know, my viewpoint, which is usually wrong anyway. I don't give a shit.
Are you talking about it like Money's like the same character effectively?
Facets of the same character, the same archetype. And strangely enough, this is the only one with a name, but that's, I've got another theory about that as well. So, because in High Plains Drifter, we have the stranger. In Pale Rider, we have the preacher. And here we have William Money. Even the name of the town this movie is set in is fictitious. It's not, like I checked. What is it called? Whiskey?
Big Whiskey.
Big Whiskey.
Yeah, it's not a real place. I mean, we're going to talk about the setting of this movie, which is fucking amazing. It's all shot in Canada for, you know, obvious reasons. It was cheaper. But it's also the scenery. I think it's shot in Alberta, isn't it? Yeah,
yeah,
and it's fucking, the scenery is amazing here. Cinematography is amazing. But I rewatched one scene 3 times this morning, which is the one with WW and Little Bill.
Yep.
How WW Beauchamp basically is like a scribe. He's like, what is he? He's a biographer, right? But he's, in your theory, Jeff, is the audience. He's us. And I agree with that as well. You know, you hinted at that. And I didn't even think about that. And it's full on. Yes, absolutely.
He's our everyman that, like, we are consumers of his product, where it's like, oh, you know, like, yes, we want to watch the high speed chase. That's an American thing.
Yeah. But that's, look, every time you get, even in the past, you know, American culture is like global for the past 50 years.
Sorry about that.
So that's all right. We know about your local elections. Like, it's, you know what I mean?
And we are blaming you, Jeff. So it is your fault.
Directly my fault.
It is. For sure.
100%. 100%. To quote Steve, 100%. Yeah. But there's a sequence where WW Beauchamp, a.k.a. the audience, is startled. He's startled by Gene Hackman toyfully drawing on him. And his reaction, that's why I was saying, I'm surprised that Eastwood does little, like, few takes as well. So this is magic. This is movie magic. When he reacts, he has his specs. His reading specs, his glasses on top of his head. As when he reacts, he kind of flinches, and you see his glasses sliding from the top of his head to his nose. Mm-hmm. It's akin to the magic of seeing Ray in Ghostbusters reacting to the first ghost they see in the library
with
or
the
restaurant.
Cigarette.
Yeah, the cigarette that sticks to his lip. That wasn't planned. That was not planned. Like, you can see it, and they kept it in. Same thing here. But right after we see that, there's a moment in which he approaches the desk where WW is sitting down. He wants to give him a further example. He knows exactly where he's like toying with prey here, Gene Hackman. Mm-hmm. But he goes to the desk and he starts rattling around, and he's making much more noise than required. Like, he's moving around the drawers of this desk and fucking around with the stool. And then he continues to make more noise to startle him further by slamming a gun, a loaded gun, on the table. Not his gun, a gun that he kept on the desk. And then the keys. And you can see that by this stage, he has obviously already had the attention of WW, the scribe. But now he's got him startled. And he's got him fearful, which goes back to what you were saying earlier. He's a fucking sadist.
Mm-hmm. Look, son, being a good shot, I mean, quick with a pistol, that don't do no harm, but it don't mean much next to being cool-headed. A man who will keep his head, not get rattled under fire, like as not, he'll kill you.
But if the other fella is quicker and fires first,
then he'll be hurrying and he'll miss. Look here. That's about as fast as I can draw and aim and hit anything. More than 10 feet away. Unless it's a barn.
But if he doesn't miss,
then he'll kill you. Yeah, that's why there's so few dangerous men around, like old Bob. Like me. It ain't so easy to shoot a man anyhow, you know, especially if some bitch is shooting back at you. I mean, that'll just flat rattle some folks. Let me show you something.
Just a minute.
Look here.
I know, just take that. Go on, take it.
The key. All you gotta do is shoot me, and you and Bob can just ride on out of here free as birds.
He's a sadist.
Yeah. I mean, I think we're jumping the gun here. Anyway, but anyway. First of all, I'll take Steve's question. Jeff, what is your history with this particular moment in cinema?
Like, as far as the film Unforgiven?
Yeah. When did you first see it? How has it affected your life? Did you name a kid after Clint Eastwood?
No, you know, it's funny. A little story here. So my middle name is Clinton.
Oh.
And it's because my dad is a massive Clint Eastwood fan.
Oh.
So yeah. So nice. It's funny, like, Clint Eastwood just kind of growing up and my dad loving his Westerns and stuff. I don't think I saw this until probably like 99 or so, you know, I just didn't have like an interest really in Westerns and in movies in particular, probably till I was, you know, 18 or so. And nice. That was the first time I saw it, but yeah. So, I mean, I have a strong emotional connection to Clint Eastwood just because he means a lot to my dad. My dad embodies a lot of like Clint Eastwood characters to me, like in my mind, you know, he's sort of that rugged
stoic. Is he stoic?
Stoic. Yes. 100%. I feel like a lot of my dad's mannerisms are probably influenced by being a fan of, you know, Leon Westerns and stuff and those characters that he grew up liking. So less on the Dirty Harry front and more on the the stranger front. So
yeah.
Does that answer your question, Ricky?
Yeah, it does. It does.
Yeah.
Okay. Is that still around?
Yeah, he is. Yeah. It's funny. I was actually just talking with him about this after I watched it. I texted him because I knew this is one of my dad's favorite movies too.
What's his name? What's your father's name?
Dad. No, Jimmy. Yeah, Jimmy Walker.
Dad.
His name is Little Bob.
So, yeah, my brother's name is Little Bill or whatever. Yeah. Yeah, you know, I texted him and I was like, hey, I just watched this for the first time in like 10 years. And it was nice to actually reconnect with my dad on things like that. My dad doesn't text well or, you know, communicate well, like whose dad does. But it was funny. He like immediately like chimed back, you know, he's like, oh yeah, it's my favorite Eastwood movie, maybe except for Outlaw Josie Wales. But yeah.
Ah, which yeah. is, so earlier Umbar said something about a trilogy and he didn't mention that film, The Outlaw Josie Wales. And I feel like there are huge connections between these two films.
I kind of would agree. Yeah.
Yeah. To an extent that I'll let you in on something. I watched this and Umbar was on the phone to me and of course Umbar's conversations are always epic and always that little bit longer than you expect them to be. But Umbar said to me, I was saying to Umbar, when I get off this phone, I'm going to sit down and I'm going to watch The Unforgiven from start to end. That's my plan tonight, start to end tonight. So I get off the phone by about 9 o'clock and I fell asleep in the last 25 minutes. Of course I did, because it was a weekday and you know what my weeks have been like, Umbar, so don't start going, fuck you, fucking, you should have watched this and fucking.
Why would you deprive me of that, though?
I thought that was a good impression of you. But yeah, anyway.
But you didn't put enough patapoopy in
but it. When I woke up, HBO Max had started The Outlaw Josie Wales. Right. So when I woke up, I saw Clint Eastwood setting up some graves and all that. And I was kind of watching it in this kind of haze, being like, yeah, I remember graves in Unforgiven and him setting up. And maybe this is the end of the Unforgiven. Okay. All right. But it looks different. Like the grain looks different and everything. And then all of a sudden,
Clint Eastwood looked younger.
I didn't put two and two together. That's how hazy my brain was. Mm. And then all of a sudden, suddenly the name Clint Eastwood comes up. And I'm like, okay, it's the end credits, whatever. And then it says, The Outlaw, Josie Wales. And I'm like, shit, I've started a second film. No, turn it off. So that was my foray this time with The Unforgiven. My history with it is that In 93, I was 9 years old, and I remember this. It must have been the first time I was aware of the Academy Awards, the Oscars, because I remember that Scent of a Woman was massive that year. I remember A Few Good Men was massive that year. Other ones like Howard's End and whatnot. And of course, The Unforgiven was huge. And so you couldn't get away from it. But again, like you, Jeff, I probably ended up being a lot older, probably 17, when I finally sat down to watch it. And I just remember going from, oh, what are Westerns? They're normally like this, they're normally like that. And then sitting down with this and being like, oh, no wonder this is like only on after 10 o'clock whenever they put it on TV. Oh,
the first 10 seconds of the movie are a woman getting assaulted with a knife.
Yeah. And it just kind of, again, it was, I think it was one of those gateway films for me.
So this was the one that attracted you to the genre? Is that what you're saying?
I saw a few Westerns beforehand, like your John Wayne's, and I also saw a few Elvis Presley Westerns, which one of them I love. And I think it, oh, I've got to remember the name. It'll come back to me in a bit. But I remember Westerns being one thing, like a Sunday afternoon on a random TV channel. This was the one that made me go, so this is what a Western can be like. And since then, it's been like my little gateway film of, you know, there is such a thing as an adult Western, which, again, we've previously covered it. If it wasn't for The Unforgiven, I probably would have never watched Old Henry, but thank God for The Unforgiven, because I watched Old Henry as soon as I could, and I love that. So,
yeah, this might be like the first kind of like prestige Western, where it like kind of like took a lot of the tropes and stuff and subverted it, you know? Like, it's funny that you said that, like, you know, this was like the first one where you realize that, and it's probably like that for a lot of people. Like, I think that people watch this movie like as like, because they hear it's a good movie, because they hear it won Best Picture and all these things, and it kind of like opens your mind to be like, well, I want to see what this is subverting. So it's like, I watched this before I watched, you know, and really got into like the Leone stuff, you know, and the spaghetti Westerns. So it's like, I wasn't aware of what it was subverting at first, or I didn't have like an understanding of film enough to really know what it was subverting. So.
Well, for me, what the world then got to know as spaghetti Westerns, they were all around me growing up.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, you have a different perspective on that for sure.
Yeah, indeed. You know, like for us it was, but then once I moved away, I kind of understood the term as well. And Leone's dad, I had to leave Italy and move elsewhere to kind of have the perception that the rest of the world has towards, you know, spaghetti Westerns. But I wouldn't even, I don't even know if the trilogy, the Dallas trilogy, can be categorized as spaghetti Western, because it's, there's almost like a B movie quality to that term. And I think in their own right, those three movies are fucking epic. You know what I mean? But it's the way they're shot, and that's Leone. So, but that's a different conversation. Growing up, like if it was a Western, it was somebody else watching it. And I saw myself as a younger passenger of that viewing. You know what I mean? And usually the ones that kind of were pleasant for me to watch, but I still wasn't attracted to because I was too young. It wasn't for me, but they were kind of, I don't know, it felt pleasant. I remember Silverado. That's one of the ones that I remember being a kid. Then after that, I remember Tombstone, but that was already too serious. So but this is the first time, right? In retrospect, I can go back. Tombstone is a, I adore that movie. You know what I mean? But I had to go back. So my ticket in, believe it or not, into the Western genre when I thought, oh shit, this is great. It's Back to the Future 3. As a kid. It was that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then as a teenager.
You sure, because you're autistic, it wasn't the flying train in Back to the Future 3 that did it for you?
It's just that the movie as a whole, obviously, it was a setting that I enjoyed because of, you know, that movie being part of a trilogy we now cherish. But as like, the movie was made for me as a kid, you know, like it's as a preteen, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like I'm 77, so about that. But I remember as a teenager when I went, this is cool for the first time. And it's not that cool in retrospect. Ricky's going to kill me for this, but it was fucking cool as hell. It was The Quick and the Dead by Sam Raimi.
All right. You didn't say Wild Wild West, so that's good.
We're all good.
It's fine. It was The Quick and the Dead. And that was...
That's Hackman 2, right?
It's Hackman 2. Yeah.
It is Gene Hackman as well.
Okay.
but it doesn't have a long-lasting quality, that movie. Somehow, if it's very off the time, you can feel the 90s pour. I mean, 90s pouring through that. But anyway, Ricky will disagree. I rewatched it recently, and it's not as cool as I remember it. It's good, and it's Raimi, but it's a bit weird. I feel about that movie like I felt about The Frighteners when we covered it. That's another conversation to be had when we do cover it, because we will do it. Then in retrospect, I went back and started watching Leone with a critical eye, and the Dollar Trilogy became something that I fucking adore from any viewpoint, like from a narrative standpoint and from a technical standpoint. This is so influential. The close-ups, you have so many people that try to emulate that or incorporate it into their own work. I mean, Tarantino's 50% of Tarantino's output is based on Leone. You know what I mean? Plus you had Ennio Morricone behind it and so much, right? But those movies have been inspiration for a lot of people, including Clint Eastwood. I think one of the people that has mourned in the industry, that has mourned Leone's passing the most, is Clint. Because they were friends, and it's the person that put him on the map, believe it or not. You know, it's also the person that he was inspired by to a level in which he wanted to be a filmmaker. He wanted to be a director, not just an actor. And I mentioned those three movies because I believe that those three movies, including the one we're talking about today, are all directed by Clint. Is Pale Rider directed by Clint Eastwood?
Yep.
There you go. Is High Plains Drifter directed by Clint Eastwood? Yes.
Yes.
I rewatched it the other day, and fuck me, that is a horror movie. It's a horror movie. George from Horror Weekly, shout out to you. You were right. I have never watched it with a lens. When I watch it now, the money goes to the entire town, paint the town red. Holy shit. Yeah. This movie is akin to that one, man. There's a lot to unpack on Unforgiven. I don't even know where to begin. We already started. But
you haven't answered the question. When did The Unforgiven enter your zeitgeist?
I'll answer it. Some point I wanted to make with Jeff. When it comes down to 1992, 1993, wherever this movie got, you know, global distribution, it's about that time. The music world, because these two things go mano a mano. It's not just the title of the song that I use for the reel on social media, Unforgiven. That song is on the Black Album. There is something that album and this movie share. It truly is, in my opinion. The Black Album put metal in the mainstream, and I think Unforgiven put Western in the mainstream. Wouldn't you? And they came out the same year. I didn't go to see it on release because it was 92. I wasn't into Western yet. It was in the side, I guess. I remember hearing about it, but I had zero interest towards it. I went back to it in, I think, 97 or 98. It was a video store thing, and it was a friend that kept banging on about it. It made me sit in front of it. But even then, I was, you know, I was closer to it, but not as impressed as I am with this movie, particularly on my last viewing. You know, which is nice. I'm not saying that I really connected with Unforgiven on the last viewing, but the last viewing was more poignant, maybe because of the situation. You know, we had to talk about it. Yeah. So
that's great, because I think we're all equal then on that, because initially this was a movie that was, we knew about it and it was in our zeitgeist because of the Academy Awards or because of somebody coming along and being like, it's amazing, it's great. But we didn't jump on it. It kind of finally entered our zeitgeist, or it entered our viewing, and we slowly got there. And I think you're totally right, mate. I think the first time I watched this, I was like, wow, what a bloody affair, you know? But this time, I've got, as much as Jeff has his great theories, I have got an overarching theory for the whole film from this viewing. But I want to go into that later, but the scenes in this, they're all like miniature plays, aren't they? They're like these they run for like each act or each scene runs for about 15 to 20 minutes each. And it doesn't like try and incorporate any other storyline. You're just stuck with these people for 15, 20 minutes. And it's so like amazing how they all connect.
It is. The structural narrative is very linear, and it's also quite simple. So you can actually focus on gravitas. And I mean, there is a theory, and it's not just a theory, but from when you look at the narrative, this has apparently been compared to the Iliad, or whatever you
Iliad,
call it.
Yeah.
And it is. It's a Greek tragedy. You know what I mean? Like it's, but it's also, when you look at the character arcs here, it's quite standard. By standard, I don't mean to devalue it in any way, shape, or form, but it's very classical. Mm. You know, the classical arcs for these archetypes. The thing is, it's when it's threaded all together, there's a lot. So it's not just the journey of one character, which is, it's very revisionistic for a Western, because normally there's a very solipsist kind of nature to a Western. You've got the hero, you've got an antagonist, or you have the anti-hero and you have an antagonist. Here's, there are six characters in this movie and they all equally. There is one thing that we get something at the beginning that is meant to shock, but there's, the very thing that starts this series of events kind of gets lost because it's not as impactful as it should be. We're reminded of it throughout, that every once in a while it's just thrown at the viewer, which is, oh, and she's disfigured and this and that. I'm not saying, it's kind of an oversight, all right? And it's a shame because this movie is near perfect. Jeff mentioned the Mandela effect, and I fucking experienced one here bad, real bad, and it hurts me because I still can't believe it. Look, I'll give you an example before I tell you what it is. My favorite shot out of Jaws is dolly zoom shot, and it's a very simple technique, but it's kind of the first time that it's so emphatic on screen. And in Jaws, it's basically Chief Brody on the beach, and he's acting surprised, and it's a very effective thing that Spielberg does. I thought that shot was much, because I love it, I thought it was much longer than it is. Okay, I thought it was like 10 seconds. It's not. It's 2 seconds long, if anything. It's super impactful, but I want more of it, and in my head, it's much longer. Here, it's not even the length of a sequence. In my head, it was shot completely differently. And either I fabricated it, or it's somewhere else in another movie, and I doubt it. I just think that this is a matter of your mind. Just, I don't know, really the artifice of memory or personal memories. In this instance, it's a sequence that to me makes the movie, and so that's why it hurts me when it's not there. Mm. It really fucking hurt me. And it's a pivotal point in the movie, but it's very nuanced here, and I wish it was more, much more emphatic than it is, because to me, that's the turning point of this movie. There's a sequence when you know all hell will break loose. Right? And because it's not as big as it is in my head, some people may have missed it. You guys probably know what it is. The kid is holding a bottle of whiskey. This is the instance in which you'll see money taking a sip out of that bottle the first time. Mm. Because obviously he keeps remarking the fact that he doesn't drink anymore. Mm. And drinking is directly correlated with him being a killer and being a fucking monster of a man, right? But here in this movie, he does it like you shouldn't even see it. He just very nonchalant. He just grabs the bottle out of the kid's hands. Like his hand goes off screen, actually. It's not even like, and he takes a sip and he continues the conversation. Mm-hmm. That's not how it was in my head. In my head, it was like a big pause, like Christopher Walken pause. You know, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. And it's not there. It's not there. So
Like George Lucas zooming in on a lightsaber falling or something, or it's like a bottle of whiskey, you know. Like,
I mean, in mine it was a monologue kind of sequence, you know what I mean? And it takes like a really big swig, so you need to know what this means, and it's not that. No. I don't know how I did that.
What I really loved about that scene is that it's not just one swig. You know how sometimes in movies it's like they kind of emphasize on the first drink? I think even The Simpsons take the mick out of it, because like Marge has like, she's got, everything's being done around the house, and I think it's the Scorpio episode, and she takes one glass of wine.
The wine, yeah.
And then she later on she takes a second one, and it's meant to signify that, and she's been drinking all day, and then later on she says, I had 2 glasses of wine. That's way too much for me, you know. And what I really enjoyed about the scene in Unforgiven is that when the girl comes and tells them of the fate of Morgan Freeman's character.
Oh, yeah. That's the sequence. That is the sequence.
Yeah, he just keeps drinking and he just keeps going for it. And every line ends with him being like, and another shot, and another shot. he's in that mind frame of this is what I have to do now. And actually, we had this conversation, and sorry, guys, we normally don't have conversations before this. Normally, there's an embargo.
We stopped.
The
embargo.
An embargo on our conversations around the same film. But I liken this to Old Man Logan or the film Logan, because this is the point in the film where it's a do or die moment. It's like he knows exactly what's going to happen. It's not going to be pretty. He may end up dead. So what the hell? I am going to drink my way through the next 20 minutes or the finale of this film. Mm. And again, it's that moment you get also in Logan where even at the start of the film of Logan, or even when you start the first issue of Old Man Logan, you know this is the run to the end. This is the last act.
It's the point of no return. That's what that is. Yeah. And that's what it marks here. You know, like it's... But this movie, man, we said revisionistic. It really is, you know. But again, there's a subtlety to it. And it's weird. It's weird because this is a big Academy Award film that made a lot of money. And sometimes those movies don't get the benefit of subtlety. But there's a ton of it here. And in that moment, for example, you need to look for it. I just thought it was much more emphatic than it is. I don't know why. And I would have done that. And probably that would have ruined the movie. I don't know. You know what I mean? And I remember talking about it endlessly with people that were sycophantic, going, yeah, man, I remember that. It's like, well, I'm not so sure now.
Yeah.
You know?
You're going to go through your list of friends and be like, he lied to me. She lied to me.
All right. So what do you guys think this movie is trying to say about violence? I think I have like an idea of like where it wants to go with it. But as far as like the women's role inside of this movie, like where it keeps going back and forth between everyone over exaggerating the nature of what was done to Delilah. I don't know what is being said about that.
It's justification, perhaps. It's to try and justify.
You see her, and after she's healed, it's honestly, it's horrific, but it's not that bad. But in the narrative that is crafted, that everyone says like why they're going to do this, it's like, ah, they cut her tits off, and you know, they gouged her eyes out, and it's like all this stuff. So there's that aspect of like, why is that happening? And then also just kind of the, I don't know what it's saying about women. Like if there's something about the vindictiveness, the spitefulness that exists with all the women, like pooling their money together and what they're out to do. I don't know what this movie's saying about that. What do you guys think? Because it's definitely a theme that's there, because it's being said a lot. And they're major characters.
Yeah, we got to be careful, because this movie was made 33 years ago. And I, as much as we, you know, we seek for even like a deeper layer, I don't know if that was intended. And I don't think it was an oversight. What's the name of the writer?
David Webb Peoples.
Webb Peoples.
Yeah, David Webb Peoples. If it was his intention, then it would be the extra layer that points out the fact that these men are trying to justify their extreme actions by exaggerating what happened.
There's an element of like what men are willing to do for the sake of a woman. Hmm.
And yes, you're right. I don't think it was intentional, particularly in the Western world as well. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I really don't know. I don't think this is about that. I really don't. I think, and that's why it's being treated that way, the topic, you know, almost overlooked, because that's the catalyst. The catalyst of this starting is, you know, the violence basically is exposed in the narrative, because it's like it's like the flick of a switch. It's like a fire starter. You know, it's a spark.
Igniter, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is it's diminutive.
Do you want me to get to my theory about what the start of all of it is?
Well, that's where you were going with this.
Of all male violence.
Go ahead.
Unforgiven. The catalyst of Unforgiven is penis anxiety.
Yeah, you did say that.
That is the catalyst. She laughs at his little pecker, and it sets off, and it which is, if that doesn't say anything about the nature of humanity, like and why we fight wars, and
absolutely. That guy dies in such an unceremonious manner, dude. He dies being killed by someone who's a fucking debutante while he's taking a shit.
A debutante who can't see.
Yeah, exactly.
Who has short-sightedness.
It's a hell of a gray stone.
The Tywin Lannister treatment died the same
way. Oh, my God. Yeah. I mean, that's a deserving death for that piece of shit, if you think about it, you know? I'm more concerned with Gene Hackman in this.
This is my theory. Now, I'm using terminology that we use currently now, but so I don't know how the terminology would have been said back in the early 90s. But I believe that this whole film is about different levels of trauma. So you have every character has some sort of trauma that they're trying to deal with. Now, it's either they're trying to deal with it to get through and just get on with their lives and forget about everything else. So you've got Bill Money, like, dealing with the fact that he's lost his wife. You've got all the women of the whorehouse dealing with the fact that their lives are traumatic. Like, every moment. That bit where Skinny, like, really, like, lays into them for, like, even starting the bounty is done with a horror lens. It's, like, so tight, and he's just screaming into the camera. Even little Bill is dealing with the fact that he led a very traumatic life, and he's trying now to be the just man, the sheriff. He's trying to be the one who has all the right to be as violent as he is. And Ned Logan, Morgan Freeman's character, is trying to start his whole life, which is later on in one of the scenes when he can't shoot. That's like PTSD, like, I just can't be. So I feel that this whole film is examining trauma, and the only character who doesn't have trauma until later on in the film is the Schofield kid. And it's said that in the script that the Schofield kid, supposedly the original script said that he went and drowned himself out of guilt.
Remorse.
After his first killing, which again, he like bigs up like, oh, I've killed loads of people. And he doesn't understand that actually the act of killing is the thing that's demeaning everyone. Everyone's being oppressed by their own like wanting for killings or wanting for violence and whatnot. So this whole film feels like what you witness in the first 15 minutes, as horrific it is, it's the birth of someone's trauma, and then it continues to expose or to investigate everyone's trauma in Big Whiskey.
That's true. But there, you know, you could also put it in the simplest terms, which is these are all Greek tragedy figures.
Yeah,
all of them are.
Yeah,
you know, and it's they're relatable, because at one point or another, I think you need to. That's why I think we all see what this movie is trying to say as adults. I think that's why this is not a movie a teenager will connect with.
No.
At this level. I think you need to have experienced some of the trauma. You need to have been Bill and Money at some point. Maybe not to those extents, but to understand, you know. I think that's, but there's a lot of movies that we have covered on this podcast that require that luggage.
Yeah. But even English Bob, because he's the one who's faking it, man. Richard Harris. As soon as I saw him on screen, I completely forgot it was Richard Harris, and he takes a whooping. But the minute you see him, he's playing it up. He's like acting like his life has led to the best thing. Like him killing loads of people and him being like one of the marked gunmen is the best thing. But you only find out later on that actually he's a complete joke. Everything he's done has been from circumstance or serendipity, and he just happened to survive it all. And it's what I actually really love about this film. And again, you're right. Hindsight, and when I saw this in the late 90s, when we all saw this in the late 90s, there's a lot of themes or a lot of scenarios that would have gone straight over our heads, and we'd just be like, oh, that was a cool scene, or oh, he was really menacing then. But the minute you start piecing them all together, like the random jigsaws that we love to do to films, this is where you start seeing that, oh my God, everybody in this town, everybody associated to this town, anywhere near this town, hates themselves. They hate what they are. They're trying their best to either leave it or just deal with it. And Gene Hackman, as much as he revels in like telling these stories and being like, oh, you know, as soon as he gets his own little biographer, he starts telling
these. Oh, he's
enjoying
it. His ego is being titillated. Yeah, that's
he still hates what he's become. And he's just doing it as circumstance sort of thing.
There are different levels to the sadistic nature of Little Bill, which are fucking fantastic. Again, it all goes back to the jail sequence. Like when he's not only being intimidated in a physical manner, but it's like there's a duality to that type of torture. Like there's a moment in which not only he's menacing, but while he's doing it, he's also destroying you. He's destroying you because he's telling the person who until that moment, you know, he had purpose. WW is fucking with WW because WW spent the last few months traveling and, you know, believing all the shit to a certain extent, you know, like he added and embellished as a writer. That's what you do. But he's doing that after he kicked him and beat him in front of everybody on the town. So that's humiliating. He's doing it in front of the guy that was writing about him as well. And I love the fact that it's almost funny, it's almost comedic. At the end, as he's being driven out of town, he's in the fucking carriage, just going, you godless Americans, fuck you. Yeah, that's funny.
You talk about it almost being funny. The first time he calls him the duck is great comedic timing in that.
Yeah, but again, that's a whole different level because he's taking the piss out of Wayne, out of John Wayne, the Duke. But that's a different story.
Sure, yeah.
That's what Clint is doing with this movie.
I didn't put that there.
Yeah. Well, the other thing is, as Richard Harris is being driven out of town at the moment, it's Gene Hackman going, I didn't ask him to stay. He wanted to stay on his own accord. Mm-hmm. I took your biographer, so it's the last fuck you.
Yeah.
Give these keys to the conductor. Tell him he can loose old Bob's cuffs as soon as he's outside the county.
Yeah. Got my pistols.
I guess you know, Bob, that if I see you again, I'm just going to start shooting and figure it's self-defense. Ha! I didn't steal your biographer. Well, he's staying on his own account.
Well, he can go stuff himself as well, can't he? A plague on you. A plague on the whole stinking lot of you. Without morals or laws. And all you whores, you've got no laws, you've got no honor. I tell you for a fact, it's no wonder you won't emigrate to America, because they wouldn't have you in England. You're a lot of savages, that's what you all are, a bunch of bloody savages. A curse on you. I'll be back.
Nobody's going to come. Huh? After what Little Bill done to that Englishman.
Man, Gene Hackman does... I don't know. I want to see more of him. That's what I'm going to do this week. Coming, I'm going to rewatch French Connection. There's a lot of stuff he's done in the 90s as well. I mean, I rewatched Mississippi Burning recently again, but I'm going to watch it again. And even the lighter stuff is always something about him. There's something Hackman did that is just, and there's always that sadistic kind of streak running through him. He's so good. So good. He wasn't easy to deal with. I think here with Hackman,
he played a good tyrant. You're right.
He did. And also they were friends. You know that the role of Little Bill was meant to go to Richard Harris. Mm. And funnily enough, I read this yesterday. Clint used to love making phone calls. So he didn't have agents or whatever. He would call you directly. You know, there's recorded accounts. I think we mentioned it on the show. Of the first intervention that Charlie Sheen had, Martin Sheen, just before Charlie was leaving, after they did the intervention for hours, he got tricked into it in his own family home. This is Charlie Sheen, right? Martin goes into his study, makes a phone call. As Charlie's leaving, he comes out and he goes, someone on the phone for you. Hands him the phone and it's fucking Clint Eastwood. Telling him, don't do drugs. And then a year later, he was in The Rookie and all of that. But apparently he called Richard Harris. And when he called Richard Harris, the purpose of the phone call was to offer him the role of English Bob. Sorry, of Little Bill. Yeah. Right? And Richard Harris thought it was a prank. Because apparently he was watching High Plains Drifter.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was watching the movie as Clint Holden. Do you know how mind-blowing that is? It's funny. Yeah. He thought it was a joke.
Okay. Yeah, so there's a really good iTunes like bonus feature that had some behind-the-scenes stuff about the making of this movie. And Eastwood and Hackman were talking about the real-life inspiration for Little Bill was Daryl Gates. I don't know if you guys are familiar with who that is. But he was the chief of the LAPD in the 90s.
No.
During the riots.
Yeah, no. So at the time when the LAPD was not... I mean, there's never been a time where the LAPD's been like in good standing in the public eye. But he was the chief of police during like Rodney King and all that stuff.
Oh my God.
And that was kind of like the inspiration. Hackman said that he didn't read too much into like what his personality was like necessarily, but that sort
for
of
this
like,
role, for this role.
He didn't want to try and politicize that too much, but Gates had a reputation as sort of being like an absolute rule follower to the T, and that was what Hackman used as inspiration for the character, was that the chief of police for the LAPD. Yeah.
Was he portrayed? Do you remember anything? But the only movie that I remember that touched that topic was Rampart with Woody Harrelson.
Mm. I don't know if he's ever been dramatized that I can recall. I could be completely wrong. There could be a movie all about it, but yeah.
It's probably Colors.
Say Colors?
It's probably Colors.
Fuck me, every time you say Colors, my instinct is to go Colors. Colors. There's no way I'm not throwing that in.
Color. I am a nightmare walking, psychopath talking. King of my jungle, just a gangster stalking, living life like a firecracker, quick as my fuse. Vendetta's a death, back the colors I choose. Red or blue, cuz of blood, it just don't matter. Sucker died for your life when my shotgun scatters. Color. The gangs of LA will never die. Just multiply colors.
Color. By the way, Duval and Penn had a reason to watch that movie. That movie aged fucking terribly. I don't know what it is. It's just the way. Is it Walter Hill?
Yes.
Just check. Yeah. Is it Walter?
I think it is. But like,
but in your mind, it feels like a Walter Hill movie, right?
Yeah. But the
was
thing,
it?
I recently rewatched it probably about 4 years ago, and it's still like, I think I rewatched it during recent LA.
Oh
acts,
God!
And I
remember this wrong. Isn't there a sequence where someone gets? I think it's Penn throwing one of the bad guys over a stove.
Mm-hmm.
And it gets burnt. Oh my God. Okay.
Oh no.
Anyway,
you know who directed Colors? Dennis Hopper.
Heineken? Fuck that shit. Pabst Blue Ribbon.
Oh my God.
And that's why it's so cutting, because of course Dennis Hopper dealt with cops all the time.
Yeah.
So did anyone else feel bad for Davey Bunting?
Yes.
Played by Rob Campbell.
Yes.
Who was trying to just do the right thing.
He's the only decent one. He's like the only decent person in the movie, it seems.
Is that the other brother?
Yeah.
I feel bad for his horse.
Well, the thing is, he's the only decent guy, but he still held her for the first slash. You know what I mean? Like, he gets caught up with all of the drama.
The guy, tell me if I'm wrong here, because if I'm right, it's mind blowing, and it goes back to the little dick theory you've got, the little dick energy theory. In this movie, in that sequence when he gets shot, there's a guy, part of his posse, that goes, "You're not going to shoot me, are you?" he wants to calm out because Eastwood, that's a beautiful sequence, by the way, when Clint Eastwood goes, "Give him some water." You know what I mean? And there's a guy that pops out behind the rock and runs over as his friend is dying.
Mm.
Please find the name of the actor, because if I remember correctly, that guy was in Scary Movie,
the first one,
and it was part of the segment about I Know What You Did Last Summer, I think, that was making fun of.
Yeah.
But there's in Scary Movie, there's a photo of a little dick. It's meant to be his dick.
Yes.
Is that the guy?
That is the guy. That is him.
What's the name of the actor?
Oh,
What's the name of the actor?
Oh, I've got to find it now. But it's that,
good on you for finding the scary movie Unforgiven connection.
I remember it.
Is it Lachlan?
That's the guy. Tell him it's the guy.
He's in
it is the
Peacemaker.
Guy. Know, mate.
He's the guy in Peacemaker.
You're
he's
joking.
Like one of yeah. He's in like 9 episodes. He's the detective in Peacemaker.
Yes, he is.
Yes,
he is.
And
yes,
he's in Totally Killer. Yeah. Let me just double.
What's his name again? What's his name again?
Lachlan Monroe. I think. Did I say that right? Let me.
Yeah, I think you did.
So I don't want to give him too much credit. I realize I shouldn't have said he's a decent person, but the scene where he comes into town with the horses and everything, and he's attempting to give Delilah the prize pony. That scene kind of sets him up as like. And again, that just goes back down to the failure of communication and that being what the movie is about. But it's like he's just trying to do the right thing and trying to make amends. And the women are so spiteful. They're just
but throwing
horse
shit
out.
There's a part
me
of you as well that goes, that's not enough, mate.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? There's a part. Yeah. There's, I get it. The intention was good. But with the tools that you were given as a man back then as well, fuck, dude, that's gallantry.
Yeah. But, it's like, I'm sorry. You know what I mean? Yeah. Here's a horse. Yeah. It's like, and it's funny, the women are like, what the fuck's she going to do with that? Like,
and the fact that he gets, like, when he's confused, he's truly confused as he's being, you know, driven out of town. It's like,
that's probably saying something about, like, the nature of, like, men trying to apologize to women. It's like,
exactly.
Yeah, I know I did something terrible. Here's a horse. Yeah.
There's so much to this film that, as you said, it's subtle. There's so much to it that is so subtle. Yeah. And if you want to watch it as a Western, it's good enough. It's great sort of thing. But if you start watching it and you start picking up on those subtleties, we've talked about Logan with his gun and not being able to fire it. Even the subtlety of you don't see Logan's death. You see him being tortured and you're watching the whole town listening to him getting tortured and they're just taking it in, but you don't actually see his death. To all of it to just add up to that final scene where everything just comes to a head. It's such an explosive film. It's one of those films that gets you ready for the final scene.
Morgan Freeman is in his fucking 60s in this movie and he's fucking ripped.
60s, really? Ripped.
Check.
Wait, how old is he now?
Check.
Oh,
I'm
my
surprised
goodness.
He's still alive. He's really old.
I mean, he's in his late 80s.
Yeah, but mate, Clint Eastwood is 94, I think.
Yes, he definitely
I think he's 94, 90, and he's still working. He's still working.
Yeah, he looked a little disheveled, though, on the last film.
Disheveled? He can still direct, mate. He was directing last year. 94, you think you fucking get to 94? Forget it.
Yeah, but can he still
I'm
say,
dead tomorrow.
Pick up that
huh?
gun.
It doesn't matter.
Did you guys watch The Mule, the one he did a few years back?
Yes, I did love The Mule.
Oh. He was so like well cast for that role. Like, and it's just him playing himself, I think, basically, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Everybody's got a neighbor like Clint.
Oh, yeah, it's the continuation of the story from Gran Torino. It's the same
guy.
Yeah.
Holy shit.
So I didn't want to do some quick math, so I'm getting the internet to tell me about
it. Tell us. By the way, I think Morgan Freeman and Gene Hackman share almost a birthday.
So Morgan Freeman is 88 now.
But there you go.
So,
he looks now like he did fucking 30 years ago, by the way.
Yeah. So, it's like, you're right. Like, 37 was when he was born. Yeah.
What do we want to talk about the finale? Like, what do we want to get into with that?
I don't know. I think the finale is something that I'd rather, like, let people experience because it's just.
Yeah, well, let's not spoil this movie entirely. Yeah. Frances Fisher. We didn't mention her at all. She's a great character actress.
She's like the madame, right?
She is, and she will also be the reason why eventually we will do Rust, because apparently she's in Rust. So Rust is not just a movie where Alec Baldwin went bang, bang to somebody. Sorry, that's what happened.
Oh, mate.
Well, it's what happened, right? Sorry, it's bad. It's very bad. It's very bad. It's very bad. But it is very bad.
Yeah, you just gave the prosecution's opening statement for the trial.
Yes.
This is a film in which Alec Baldwin like, bang, bang. And it's like, all right, throw it out.
Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, bang, bang. That's it. That's it.
Oh, please put in Nancy Sinatra's bang, bang right here. Thank you.
and he was six. We rode on horses made of sticks. He wore black and I wore white. He would always win the fight. Bang, bang, he shot me down. Bang, bang, I hit the ground. Bang, bang, that awful sound. Bang, bang, my baby shot me down.
So, according to a couple of areas, the
man, Frances Fisher's done a ton of work.
Of course she has. She's like,
oh, no, but in television, she's fucking in good stuff, like a lot of good stuff. So, I always remember it to be like the Oracle in a movie. Like, she's always like,
yeah, well, Dooms. She's kind of like the Oracle in this, really.
I think it's ratings times.
Whoop, 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 whoop.
Mm-hmm. Jeff.
All right. So my rating for Unforgiven is a 10. It's a 10 out of 10. Like, I think it's a perfect movie. There's really not any flaws that I can think of when I sit back and reflect on it.
Doesn't pass the Bechdel test.
That's
It does pass it.
Yeah, I think it's just, it's a fascinating analogy of violence, of communication, of human nature. Again, I know we talked about it a lot. I think you have six major characters that are all kind of interacting. Everyone's lying to themselves. Everyone's a complex character. Every character has an arc that's, you know, well-established and thought out and has a resolution. It's a very good movie. Like, we've talked about a little bit in this of, like, show, don't tell, which is something that I always respect. And I love when movies do that, where it's things are sort of revealed, you know, just via the narrative as opposed to exposition. I think this movie is excellent at that. Strong performances. It's tough to say, like, who gives the best performance in this out of all the leads. So, true. Yeah, I give Unforgiven 10 prize ponies. yeah. So that's my rating.
Get the fuck out of here with those ponies.
What the fuck are we going to do with those ponies? Yeah.
Okay. So I have to say that on this viewing, and maybe because of the conspiracy theory or the elements that I've talked about earlier,
Pepe Silva.
Yeah, this is a great film. This is a film that you can sit on and you can see lots of different aspects and you can think about it, talk about it with your friends, and it's one of those films that doesn't go away. It's a film that I am ready to watch it again today, tomorrow, whenever. I am going to give this one an 8.6. I think there's something really fabulous about it. There are those issues that we've talked about where would it work in this time? During this time, there are certain elements that do, and there's certain elements that are slightly problematic, but the good thing about this film is that you can go into it and have your mind open, and it will make you look at other Westerns and make you think, yeah, this is great. So what is this? It's an 8.6 Ducks of Death.
That's not bad, man. That's not bad. To me, this is it's an 8.5. It's an 8.5. This is a brilliant movie. Surprisingly enough, because it's a period piece, all right, it we were talking about the topic of nature not working by today's standards, for example, in some aspects of it, you know. So the movie can't be demonized for it because it's on the fringes of what this movie is about. So they're there if you look for those points, but they're not dominant enough to demonize them, you know what I mean? And on top of that, this movie has the benefit of being a period piece. It has the benefit of something portraying a different time, a different place. Yet again, the topics examined about human nature are current. You know, they're not just in our zeitgeist. It's a cyclical thing that will never stop. It's human nature. And there's an examination of those dark sides. There's very little light in this movie. Before, we were toying around and, you know, at the same time pointing a finger and shining a light on the bad aspects of the patriarchy. It's true. That is the catalyst for this movie. And everything that is bad about this movie, everything that is evil about this movie, it's a reflection of the darkness of that toxic masculinity, of that ego. And I don't think that will ever stop. We can get better at it, perhaps one day, but I don't think I'll be around to see it. Neither will you.
And on that encouraging thought.
Yeah. No, I mean, it is dark. This isn't a cheery movie, man. It's not just tragic. It's actually dark. You can revel in some of the artistry and the skill portrayed by the actors in it. Gene Hackman is fantastic in it. But to shine a light to that extent on those dark sides, here it's done in a way that it's not depressing. It's almost joyous to see a generation of actors that could do that. You know, even when you're given little exposition, you're sold something. All the performances are believable. And that's insane to do, because the Wild West may as well be science fiction. It's a world so distant. And I think there's a lot of other people in the industry that have reveled within this theme that is kind of palatable to people now, thanks to someone like Taylor Sheridan. He brought that to the masses. You could argue that, what's the name of that series about the dynasty of Yellowstone? You know, Taylor Sheridan is those are Westerns, but he it's a different facet, right? And yet again, that's Game of Thrones for most people. It brought it to the masses. It's great. It's that entertainment. It's good in its own right. But now that setting is not just historical. I mean, the Wild West was always imbued in some kind of folklore because recorded history was different. So it's nebulous, right? Perfect place for fiction to thrive, because you're fucking around with this delicate balance between folklore and history. And that leaves room for mythologies. And that's why this movie is so akin to Greek tragedies, because that is mythology, classical mythology. And the Wild West is the closest fucking thing in fiction to it. So this movie is an 8.5. It's an 8.5 mud pits full of pigs. And on that note, this was Umba.
This is Ricky.
I'm Jeff.
Sally Two Trees never spoke a word, did she? This doesn't pass the Bechdel test.
Yeah.